Welcome to another episode of That's So Cincinnati. I'm excited to welcome, well, I'm here with my co-host, Burl Love. Hi, Burl.
Hi, Sherry.
I'm excited about our guest today. I haven't seen him in a while. My former co-worker, Paul Dougherty.
Well, why in the world would we be having Paul Dougherty as our guest on the podcast? I mean, he just retired from the Enquirer, what, 2 years ago?
Time flies. But to be fair, we care what he thinks about sports, but that's not why we're having him.
But he will forever be associated with his time here at the Enquirer as our sports columnist. He has fans throughout the region, and he is among a group of sports journalists, Cincinnati premier sports journalists, who are going to be inducted into the Society of Professional Journalists Hall of Fame.
Yes, there's 9 of them. It's happening next Monday night. They do this every year, but this is like the big sports year. I'm really looking forward to it. Let me read off who's being inducted, because everyone, even me, like not like a huge sports person, knows who these people are.
All right, let's hear it.
So the inductees include Kevin Barnett, WKRC, Ken Brew, WKRC, Paul, John Fay, we know John, love John, our former Reds beat writer who passed away, Denny Jansen, Wayne Box Miller, WLW, John Popovich, WCPO, Betsy, female trailblazing sports journalist who was our podcast guest just a few weeks ago, and George Vogel, WLWT.
Does she have one name just like Doc?
Oh, did I say that? Sorry.
Betsy Ross, not the one who showed the flag, but Betsy Ross of Cincinnati sports journalism fame. Right. Trailblazing was on ESPN. She's still on the scene, not at all retired, although she's not doing
Fox 19. She has a show.
Exactly. And like you mentioned, in addition to Paul Dougherty from the Enquirer, John Fay, who, as you mentioned, passed away, but was a longtime beat writer for us covering the Reds. That'll be a nice addition to the Hall of Fame to have those legendary sports journalists in our community honored. And we will have the man himself, Paul Dougherty, here catching up with him. He's retired, but he's not idle, so it'll be fun catching up with Doc.
Yes, I would not use the word idle. He writes like 4 columns a week still. That's not idle.
But what do we have in the news you want to talk about this week, Sherry?
You know what? I want to talk about something that flew a little bit under the radar, but I think is going to be a very big deal coming up. And it's something we've written a lot about, but just not in this way. We have written in the past several months, there's been a lot of violence on Fountain Square and what's going on. And a lot, it has seemed to have tamped down a bit. There's like a lot of, you know, outreach workers there, like making sure things stay safe at Government Square. It's Fountain Square, Government Square, kind of all rolled into one where the buses come for the transfers downtown. And so that's, you know, long been how things work here. But we learned that Metro is considering relocating Government Square to the Riverfront Transit Center, this huge transit center that was built years ago and never used. And I honestly think this is going to be a very big deal coming up.
So fill me in on some of the details. The Government Square Metro transfer is the place where if anybody is coming into the center of the city and needs to connect to any bus going north, south, east, and west, that's where you end up. I mean, the Metro network over the years has added other places to connect, but really, truly, this is the main transfer hub for the system.
Yes, and so this is so journalism. They put out requests for proposals to do a study, but they're going to do the study, and it's to about whether they should relocate Government Square's downtown site to the Riverfront Transit Center, move Government Square traffic somewhere else downtown and relocate Metro's downtown stop at 5th and Walnut to somewhere else. And it just, so this flew under the radar, but it's like, why move it now? And you cannot help but connect the dots of all of the problems that we've had there and the concern. At the same time, we're seeing 3CDC has created the Fountain Square District. They are doing the convention center, wrapping around to Paycor headquarters that's going in the old Saks building. They put the Davidson in next to Jeff Ruby's, and it's a big push for 3CDC. And Government Square is right there.
Well,
is that where it belongs?
So I'll ask the naive setup question for you. What's the big deal with having a Metro hub next to the Fountain Square District?
Let's talk about the pros and the cons. There have been concerns about violence and all, and you know, problems at this big transfer area that has required a lot of police resources. And so you would say, okay, well, should we move it away from like these premier areas of our city, Fountain Square? This district's going to be very important to tourism. We're going to have tourists walking all over that area, and you really don't want any problems. So that's kind of like, well, that's why you would move it. But it's never really been moved to the transit center at the banks because it's really considered too far for people to walk to what they need to do downtown.
Like in the central business district, yeah, you do have, what, 1, 2, 3, 4, like a 6-block walk if you're going to get, let's call Fountain Square the center of the business district. You are walking, 5 city blocks if you are down in the underused transit center. That's correct.
So I think these are kind of like the reasons, like why are we looking at this and what it's going to mean? This is the very beginning of this conversation. And I will be interested to see what they think about using the transit center. And it comes up from time to time. Should we use the transit center we built? Which kind of makes sense. But then every time it comes up, people are like, it's really just too far for people. And so I took a lot of interest in this one.
So what are the, besides the distance, what are the other like arguments against moving it?
Well, I think that the access to downtown.
Okay.
Like you can't just say, okay, there's some violence and then the whole thing has to change. So that would really be a reason not to do it. I mean, dropping people off in the center of the city seems like it should be something that should be able to happen.
So when we talk about violence, Government Square has been one of the areas where compared to other parts of the Central Business District, criminal activity, drug activity, that's where people who are homeless or people who are wandering the streets who are mentally ill end up there. I, a few years ago, did a ride along with the Cincinnati Police Department, and twice in the evening, we cruised by Government Square, and the officer who was riding me along was trying to move people along who were basically just sleeping on the benches there. If you are someone who relies on Metro to get you around, I can't imagine that it's an enjoyable place to be sitting there waiting for a bus, especially in the evening at hours. So long way of asking you the question, is this just moving the problem to another area? And how do you think people in the banks feel about that proposal?
So, I mean, I suspect that it might be moving the problem, but the question is, and I don't know the answer to this, and I was just talking about this earlier today, is the transit center better set up to handle this? Like, what is the transit center like inside? And I'm going to tell you, I bet I have written thousands and thousands and thousands of stories. And I have written about this issue before, but not retained all of the details about the transit center because just it was so long ago. And is it set up? Because somebody said to me, like, well, what's it like inside the transit center? And I don't remember. So I think that that's going to be a question at hand, and it's something I want to look at, to be honest, kind of pretty quick. Like, what is what's it like in there? Like, it's city asset or county asset. and can it handle this? And is the distance the problem, or is it the structure itself, like of how it's set up? Like, really, why aren't we using it?
Okay. Well, that'll be interesting to watch how this plays out. What kind of timetable do you think that they're on as far as making a decision?
Well, the fact that they're just putting out an RFP to find a person to do the study. I mean, this is a year in the making.
At least. Okay. So lots of time for people to come out either, opposed, against, in favor. You know, there's a lot of time for people to get lined up here and like we do sometimes in our town on issues like this. Everybody will want to weigh in. So, okay.
No, and they should be able to. The bus system belongs to everybody. There's a transit tax. It belongs to every person in this county. And where they think that this should be is important. Like a citizen, like their thoughts on this, I matter. This is, does not need to be a decision made behind the scenes. This needs to be a very public discussion.
All right. Well, speaking of Metro, we have reported in the past on some of the enhancements that I alluded to, more routes with that transit tax, they were able to add additional routes, add non-traditional services for Metro. We're in select neighborhoods. They have small vans that can connect people to bus stations or get people from point A to B within that area. Lots of good things happening. However, they are dealing with, and we have a special report if anyone wants to dive more into it, the aftermath of a couple of unfortunate incidents where people have been injured or killed in accidents involving Metro, the most high profile of which was a woman who was struck by a bus. The driver, it was found, had a history of traffic violations before he even became a Metro driver, and is facing sentencing for reckless operation. So we decided to kind of dig into the safety data of Metro to see what we found. And we found, that they are really struggling with driver retention for all of these different routes and have a hard time keeping drivers employed. And the story looks at, that and other factors that have led to Metro drivers behind the wheel that probably shouldn't be. So it's a very comprehensive story done by our intrepid reporter, Patty Gallagher Newberry. So if you haven't seen that yet, I recommend people take a look at that story. And we also have a, I won't say a rebuttal, but a response from the CEO of Metro, who's weighing in on it as well. So lots of information for people to dive into if they want to keep up to speed with everything that's happening with Metro and our public transportation. So should we now, Sherry, talk about sports journalism and the noteworthy career of one Paul Daugherty?
Absolutely.
All right, let's bring on Paul.
Special guest time here on That's So Cincinnati. I already introduced our special guest, so it doesn't, and it really didn't even need that much of an introduction. But welcome, Doc.
Thank you, Sherry.
A one name thing. That's like Cher is here.
Yeah. You know, you've made it when you go by one name and people know who you are.
Well, I'm honored and privileged and all that good stuff to be here. It's so really great to see you guys.
We do want to say congratulations, which was kind of the impetus of having you on the Cincinnati Society of Professional Journalists. It does have a Hall of Fame and there's amazing people in it. And so it's going to be a good time with all the sports reporters being inducted.
Right. This was the year of the sports reporter. You can't have a sports Hall of Fame in Cincinnati without Paul Daugherty.
Exactly.
In that list, otherwise it loses all its legitimacy. So.
Yes.
Well, thank you for saying that.
So we want to talk about that career a little bit. The Doc story, Doc. This is your life. let's go back to the beginning. When did you decide you wanted to be a sports writer? Or did you decide? Did it call you?
No, I always wanted to be a writer. And I never considered myself talented enough to be a novelist or something of that nature. I needed a regular paycheck, so I gravitated toward news. And I started my career as a news writer. I covered county government in Carroll County, Maryland, which is now a suburb of Baltimore. Back then, it was out in the sticks. And I did that for a year, and I was kind of getting burned out on, you know, like zoning meetings and sewer hearings.
I know nothing of this.
And I was looking for something else, and as luck would have it, the sports editor changed jobs. So there was an opening in sports, and I said, well, you know, I like sports, and I can write sports, and it's better than covering sewer meetings. So I took the job in Carroll County and covered five high schools, you know, and we were a three-man sports department, you know, me and two other guys, and worked really hard, loved every second of it, and that's how it started.
So the idea of covering sports as a reporter is a lot different than being a columnist. When did you start to interject opinion into your work?
When I got here. I got hired in December of 87 by Barry Forbes at the Cincinnati Post as a columnist. Before that, I'd been a national takeout feature writer at Newsday in New York. And the job of columnist appealed to me, one, because it's the best job in the sports department, but two, it allowed me to write more so than even the takeout job in New York. So, yeah, I never said my goal in life is to be a sports columnist at a major metro paper. It just sort of, like a lot of things in my life, it just sort of happened that way.
Now, did you live in New York, or were you just writing for a New York publication?
I was working in Dallas at the Old Times Herald when my boss there took a job, number two in charge at Newsday in the sports department, and he brought me with him, in essence. We stayed in Dallas for about 6 months after I got hired because they loved the fact that I was in the middle of the country and very close to an airport that could get me anywhere pretty quickly. So if they needed a national story covered, you know, I was the guy.
So you would jump from Dallas to go wherever, L.A., Chicago?
Yeah, and I eventually made the call that I didn't like being away from the people I worked with. I was sort of out here on this island. I didn't know anybody except by telephone. And so I made the decision that we should move to New York, and that was probably a mistake. making New York money in Dallas was pretty good.
Yeah.
And not dealing with a lot of the hassles in Dallas that I did eventually have in New York, you know, it wasn't the best move, but it all worked out in the end.
Did you know much about Cincinnati before you took the job here?
You know, I was here when Pete was chasing Cobb.
Working for Newsweek?
Working for Newsday.
Newsday, I mean, yeah, sorry.
I was here before that to cover, Virginia Tech against the Bearcats at Nippert Stadium in the early 80s when I was working in Norfolk, Virginia. So I knew of the city, but, you know, my knowledge of what it was really like here was none. I had none.
In your wildest dreams, did you think that this would be the place where you plant the flag, so to speak? Grow the roots?
Not initially. I thought that this would be another stop, and we'd made enough stops at that point that we're getting a little tired of it, and we're starting to have kids, and it grew on me, and I got offered jobs at the LA Times in the early 90s, and twice I turned them down, because I was smart for once in my life, I said, well, if I'm going to turn down the Los Angeles Times twice, there must be a reason that I'm doing that. And the biggest reason was we liked it here. Very easy place to live, easy place to raise kids. Housing, at least then, back in the late 80s, early 90s, was very affordable. Good schools, safe, you know, and most of the big time, quote unquote, stuff in big cities you have here. And that included my job.
This is exactly how Alex and I feel, by the way, because this was not the end game.
Yeah.
But then you're here and you're covering big city news in a lovely place that we love. And it just happens.
Yeah. And I remember calling a buddy of mine who was a pretty well-known sports columnist at the Chicago Tribune, Bob Verdi, old guy. And I asked him, I said, you know, what do you think about this L.A. gig? And he said, well, do you like where you are? I said, yeah. He said, is it a pain in the ass to live there? I said, no. He said, well, are you going to cover most of the stuff in Cincinnati that you will cover in Los Angeles? I said, yeah. I mean, I traveled a lot and went to a lot of great stuff. He said, well, why are you even asking me this question? So, you know, that was from a guy who was probably 25 years older than I was and, you know, infinitely more seasoned as a writer and traveler of the world. So, yeah, I mean, again, like everything else in my life, we just sort of worked out. I didn't give it a ton of thought. I kind of let it happen and it's all been great. I've been very lucky.
So you arrive at the Cincinnati Post as the sports columnist. And we're going back to where there were two newspapers in Cincinnati, the Afternoon Post and the Morning Enquirer. If memory serves, because that's a little bit before my tour of duty began, Tim Sullivan was the lead columnist for the Enquirer.
Yeah.
What was that like competing, you know, where you have, you know, two newspapers, two sports columnists? Was it competitive?
I think so. Yeah. Yeah, we were, you know, the Post being an afternoon lower circulation paper, we saw ourselves as, you know, the scrappy little underdog, which, you know, obviously I guess most people would. And the Enquirer always lit a fire under us, and we always made fun of the people who worked here. And there was a nice camaraderie owing to that fact, because we never, you know, if we'd go to an event, it was a running joke. How many people the Enquirer have here? And the Enquirer always had like one more person than we did. Super Bowl, Final Four, Olympics, whatever it was. We were always down in the count. So, there was definitely competition.
Competition is part of the fun, just saying.
And there's still competition. It's a lot different now, as you know. What were some of the, when you came here,
well, was it hard to come here? Was it hard to leave the Post?
No, because I knew the situation with the JOA, the Joint Operating Agreement, and I knew at that point that we wanted to stay here, and I knew that option would not be available if I stayed at the Post. So I actually approached Larry Beaupre, who was the editor of the Enquirer at the time, and you know, basically laid it out for him at lunch. You know, I want to stay here. I like it here. I think I'm pretty good at what I do. If you ever need a second sports columns, you know, and again, as luck would have it, he did. So that worked out.
A second sports columns? I know nothing of this time, but okay.
What were some of the most enjoyable or challenging the stories when you first came to Cincinnati and you were still at the Post? Take us back to what was the sports scene at the time? What were the big stories? What were you immersed in? You know, who was the first person you pissed off with a column?
I don't remember that, but what I remember is that at that time, between 1988 through, I don't know, 2002 or 3, it was the absolute best place in America to write a sports column. I mean, Burrow, if you go back and think of who the personalities were at that time and what the major teams were doing, it was amazing. Bob Huggins, Marge Schott, Pete Rose, Sam Weish, Boomer Esiason, Bob Huggins, 1992 Final Four, 1990 Wire to Wire. There was something here every day. I mean, I could write a column on Marge Schott every day. You know, and no two of them would be alike. My buddies in New York, because they're New Yorkers, kind of snickered when I left. Well, why would you want to leave here to Cincinnati? I said, I don't know. Have you been following the news over the last 3 or 4 years? It's phenomenal. I don't ever remember once sitting in my office at my house, waking up my coffee saying, what the hell am I going to write today? It was always there. It was always gift wrapped. Like every day was Christmas, man. What did Marge do last night? Oh my God, let's write about that. You know, what did Mike Brown do? Yeah, I mean, you remember that time. It was nuts. It was nuts in a very good way for somebody who wrote Sports Opinion.
You know, when you rattled off that list of personalities, there are quite a few quote unquote Greek tragedies there. I mean, or at least waiting to happen. Yeah. You know, Huggins, Marge Schott, obviously. Those are more than sports stories. Mm-hmm. Those are stories of the human condition. And you have never been shy about being more than a sports writer.
Yeah,
I think that's one of the things that has defined you, your career, is that, you know, there's guys that stay in their lane with sports, and then there's guys like you that drive all over the road. It all comes back to sports, but we're talking about the stories of people and their challenges and their flaws and everything like that. That's not really a question, but I just want you to kind of think about that. Was that conscious, or is that just how you evolved as a journalist and a writer?
I'd say both. I mean, I try to write about what interests me and what I think will interest the readers, obviously. What pitch Jose Rijo threw to Mark McGwire in the World Series, I couldn't care less. I still cringe when I listen to Reds games on the radio and the guys have to tell me what every pitch is. Fastball, slider, changeup. I don't care.
Exit velocity.
Yeah, I don't care about that. What I care about is the people that you're writing about or describing. So I always found people that I covered more interesting away from the field, if you could get them to open up and if they had something to say. I mean, Joey Votto being exhibit A of greatest combination of player and thinker ever, at least for my book. I always tried to put a face on the people that I was writing about. I think that's part of a columnist's job, not just to go out there with the chainsaw and rip everybody, but to try to tell the readers a little bit more, something that they could not learn from reading a game story or watching a TV or radio broadcast, telecast.
How has that changed now? Changed and evolved while you were still here, of the different ways people are consuming news?
Oh, tremendously. And not for the good, if you're me. Social media gave these guys their own platform that they could define themselves however they liked, you know, create an image of themselves that suits what they want it to be. They don't need people like me. I was never under the impression that these guys owed me anything. I never held it against a coach or a player if he didn't like me or didn't want to talk to me. I mean, hell, halftime, I wouldn't want to talk to me either, right?
Same.
The worst nightmare is, you know, me coming toward them with a cassette tape recorder. Remember those?
I do. Not while I was here, but I used them in my career.
Yeah. So that's difficult because they don't need you. If they ever did, I think they did in some small way. They thought I could influence a public perception of them one way or another. Yeah. That's made it harder. Obviously the decline of all media, mainstream media, has hurt, because it used to, you know, I could walk into whatever, Xavier basketball practice and tell them who I was and what I did. And that would carry some weight. Especially at a place like Xavier, where they had some local players, guys who played in high school here. Oh, yeah. You know, I love them. My dad used to read you. But anyway, that's diminished, too. So in every way, it's, I think, become harder to get to know these guys in even a superficial way.
I think, too, just the way professional sports has changed. There seems to be less of a, I mean, there's some players that manage to kind of crack through and connect to the community, but a lot of players don't. This is just where they happen to play. People don't move here anymore if they're professional athletes. It's rare to have someone be part of the community. Do you think that makes it a little harder to find what the story is or where you connect?
Yeah. Yeah, because if they're around here, they're around here, you know?
Right.
And people will see them. People will talk to you. I saw so-and-so at the mall, and he was doing this. I saw Chad Johnson at Jay Alexander's buying dinner for 12 people, you know? Mm-hmm. Bang, column.
Right.
So what do you think? Because I agree with that, but Joe Burrow does live here and he's very concerned. Like he's very connected to his hometown in mm-hmm. Athens, and he does care about our community, but he's such a superstar. Doesn't seem like he can be that because he can't. I saw him over at Christmas time in Soto, and it just, everyone kind of knew not to bother him and give him a minute, but he couldn't. It wasn't the same as seeing Andy Dalton, who I once saw in Boca, who like talked to you and took pictures. And it's like, what do you think about, is he the biggest superstar we've ever had? Like, what is that?
Bengal superstar or superstar?
Is there a bigger superstar than him? That's like
I'd say any time a big red machine guy walked into a room, he'd be better. He'd be a bigger superstar, I think, than Joe Burrow. Also, I mean, Munoz, and he's accessible. He lives here. That's a great example of what you're talking about. You know, everybody knows Anthony Munoz.
But he's been retired how many years now?
Oh, man, yeah. 20 at least. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
So talking about big superstars, you, over the years, have developed, I guess I would call, a rapport with Pete Rose. You've had tremendous access to him as a writer and a columnist. What's your reaction to the two big pieces, I call it additions to the Pete canon, that dropped this year? You have the HBO documentary, you have the book, his name's blank. O'Brien, right? Yeah, Burl. I'm looking at Sherry like I'm reading the book, finishing the book now. Did you watch the documentary? Have you seen any of that?
No. I haven't watched it, didn't read the book.
Is that because there's nothing left to be said about it that hasn't been said, or it's just too, it's
that, that's part of that for me.
You want to look away from the train wreck, or?
No, I witnessed a train wreck up close and personal. And maybe there's some things about Pete in the book or in the documentary that I don't know. But I just, I don't know. I'm not one to dwell. What's done is done. And the Pete story was the biggest story of my career. Certainly the longest story of my career. And as you said before, Burl, Greek tragedy writ large. But I've been there, done that. I don't need to know any more about Pete Rose, the Anderson Ferry River Rat, or, you know, how his dad took him to the racetrack, or any of a million stories that we've all heard over and over again. And it all comes down to the Pete belong in the Hall of Fame. And I got sick of writing that column 25 years ago. And I probably wrote it 10 more times after that, you know? So, no, long
answer. Do you think you're going to write it again?
I don't know. I mean, maybe when he dies. He's not getting in now. Posthumously, I don't know. The veterans don't like him enough to get him in. Obviously, his time with the writers expired a long time ago. The only hope he has is that people who do the voting and the thinking about the rules will develop a conscience and understand that in this age of mass gambling, keeping Pete Rose out of the Hall of Fame is somewhat hypocritical, shall we say. But I don't know. I don't see Pete in the Hall of Fame while he's still alive. And that's a shame. That's tragic. And I never said any more. I said, get him in, identify him as who he is, an obsessive, addictive gambler, but also a guy who has more hits than any player in the history of the game. You want to make a special plaque for him? Make it. I don't care. Separate the player from the gambler.
I agree with you. And as our readers point out often, he might not have the official plaque in Cooperstown, but he's all over the Hall of Fame just because of the records, the memorabilia, mm-hmm. you know, three World Series. So speaking of World Series, was the 90 Reds wire to wire the most unexpected and fun story you wrote that you covered? What was the where did you just really like sit back and say, you know, I'm living the life right now. This is amazing.
Yeah,
that I'm telling this story. I have a part in this.
Yeah, the 88 run to the Super Bowl. That was my first year in town. It's funny. My career was bookended by Bengals Super Bowl appearances. I got here in 88 when they won it, and I left in whenever it was 22 when they lost it. But they got there. I like the 88 thing because it's all new to me. You know, everything was new. And that team, that Bengal team, was especially colorful with Boomer and Icky Woods and Reggie Williams, Chris Collinsworth, David Fulcher, and on and on and on. It was a pleasure to cover that team. That was back when you really did have decent access and players who didn't mind talking to you. That said, the 90 team, you could almost see that coming. I mean, Pete had gotten them to second place four times in a row. He hadn't gotten them over the hump, but he'd gotten them close, and you could see the core of the team was there. They could be good enough to win it all. And then they started the year, as I recall, winning eight or nine in a row, and the season started late for some reason I can't recall, and they started in Houston instead of here, and won three or four there, and obviously they never left first place. And the personalities there were as good or better than the Bengal personalities. You know, you had Eric Davis, you had Barry Larkin. These guys were all young and improving, right? They weren't trying to hang on. They weren't fighting for positions. They were established, but they were stars already. And, of course, you had Lou, who was the ringleader of the whole thing, who the last manager I've ever heard of a player saying that he was afraid of the manager. You know, Billy Hatcher said that to me one year in spring training. We wanted to do well because we were afraid of Lou. That just doesn't happen anymore. Players are not afraid of the manager or the coach or whoever the authority figure is. They were
definitely
afraid of
not
Lou.
David Bell.
No, not David Bell. I love him. Totally different vibe, but they were afraid of Lou. That, you know, he would throw a food spread at him or punch him out, or like he did with Rob Dibble or something. But yeah, so those two the same probably.
Right. When you went down that list, you didn't even mention the Nasty Boys. That's so let's shift gears a little bit too. We have to talk about Paul Daugherty, the author. The author of a book.
Yes, I'm an author.
Where a lot of Cincinnati sports fans, you've won them over. You still write, we should mention. You can still read Doc. He does his morning line via email, I believe, because I get it every time you write it. So do you want to give a plug of how people, if they don't know how to keep reading you,
I mean,
they can find you?
It's amazing to me, Burl. It's the number of people that still come up to me and say, man, I really miss you. I wish you were still writing. It's like, man, I've been doing this Substack thing for a couple of years now. But anyway, yeah, it's on the platform called Substack, which is basically a home for late great writers who are still alive.
Who can't stop writing.
Yeah, who needed his therapy or something
like
to do.
Niche writers, too. Like somebody wants to write about being like a Generation X, or like there's not like a place in traditional media. It's a different kind of...
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's very specific. Mine is anyway, to Cincinnati sports. And I write it probably four times a week, and I often have a guest write it on Fridays. So if you're interested, you guys, you feel free to send me 1,200 or 1,300 clearly crafted words and we could run it on
time. So yes, you can find you on Substack through there. You can subscribe to the email.
TheMorningLine.substack.com. The Morning Line, all one word. Or if you just want to Google my name and Substack.
Yes, it'll come up.
It'll
pop up. It's free once a week when I decide to make it free that day. No scheduled day. If you want it all the time, 4 or 5 times a week, it's $8 a month and $80 a year. Bargain at any price, man.
Beer money, right?
Beer money.
There you go.
You could buy a craft beer at Jungle Jim's, or you could buy a month of, the morning line.
Yeah. I mean, there's still no shortage of sports to write about, because even if it's not wire to wire or Super Bowls, we have so many sports here. I mean, do you think that's unique to Cincinnati? Because I watch our sports department. I mean, it's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. There's always a sport somewhere. Yeah.
I would say no. I would look at a place like Milwaukee, similar size, maybe smaller than Cincinnati. More sports, if you count the Green Bay Packers, which they do. You know, they've got the NFL, the NBA, Major League Baseball. They've got 3. We have 2. Milwaukee, probably St. Louis, although maybe St. Louis is more Cardinals specific. You know, the Cardinals are pretty much everything there. I think more so the smaller cities, because more than the large cities, that's a bigger chunk of our identity. You know, if in New York, if the Yankees don't do well, nobody's going to, jump off the Brooklyn Bridge or anything, Triborough Bridge. You know, it's just a small part of what New York is. Here, it's a bigger part.
We felt that in L.A. when we went to the Super Bowl. Like, I mean, this whole city was orange and it was everything for the whole 3 weeks. But in L.A., there was like, it wasn't.
Most people were like, the Rams are in the Super Bowl?
When you were there, you didn't, everything wasn't yellow. The entire city wasn't lit up yellow every night.
Yeah. Well, and then they've got the advantage of the weather there, which we don't have. In the wintertime around here, what else are you going to do?
I do think that you said something interesting that is such a big part of our identity.
Yeah.
Because there's so much talk about the Bengals and the stadium and renovating it and could they leave, and that conversation just never really goes away, and it's TikTok to 2026 when some decisions have to be made about that lease. They're never letting it go. It is part of our identity. We're looking at the stadium right now, and they're not going to be like that just can be a ghost town. I never, ever can picture that in my head.
Well, I hope you're
I don't
right.
know what the solution looks like. But there will be a solution. They're not going to be abandoned, a bookend of the banks that's sitting on our riverfront and such a big part of our identity. I find that hard to imagine. I never say never, but
I hope
it
you're
is
right.
a big part of our identity.
Yeah. I'm not sure at the moment, because I don't have my ear to the ground like I used to. I'm not sure at the moment how they make that happen. All I see is other places of stadia of similar vintage as this one being abandoned. The Browns are the latest. They want a stadium in the suburbs. I forget the name of the little suburb, but they don't want to play in the place they're playing now. Perfectly good place, by the way. It just doesn't make them enough money. But Cleveland did it. Tennessee already did it for a stadium that's a year or two older than this one. Yeah, they've already broken ground on a new stadium down there. Where else? Buffalo needed a new stadium, but they're getting a new one. It comes a time when you got to pay the piper. And like you said, Sherry, maybe they find a way to get it done. I don't even know if it's a tax, it's got to go to a vote. And I don't know how the people around here would feel about it. That's why I've said since Burrow got here, most important football player in the history of Cincinnati football, because the way this team does with him as quarterback is going to go a fairly long way, I think, in determining people's attitudes about whether they want to support the Cincinnati Bengals long term with their tax dollars.
I think the arrival of Burrow, the trip to the Super Bowl, has changed the tenor of the conversation to, you know, let them go if they want to, we got to keep them here now. So I think it's changed the political dynamics a little bit. I think, you know, the Browns and Blackburns are got the driver's seat back a little bit.
To be clear, we have not heard that from commissioners.
No, that's just
we have not heard that out of the county.
That's just sports talk here.
All right. But you said like politically, like people are definitely being nicer about things, it does seem like. We do not know about the political
will. Winning product changes everything, mm-hmm. I think. But what those other deals have shown is that the days of a county, a municipality taking the lion's share of that expense are over. And I guess the question I hear is, are the Browns, Blackburns there as well? Or are they in denial of that? Because if you listen to the commissioners, especially Elisa Reese, there's, you know, it's going to be a 50-50 split at best. And that's not what this team has enjoyed over the last 20 years.
No, and knowing that family the way we do, that's a pretty tough ask. You know, I mean, what's the stadium going to cost in Buffalo? I forget what the number is, in the billions. I mean, if you think that family's going to pay half of a billion and a half or whatever the hell it would cost, I don't know. Especially when they, you know, there's other places they can go.
Nobody is asking for a new stadium. They're asking for fixes to the current stadium.
Which makes it unique, so.
But every time another new one comes online or is in the process of being built, those people down there are looking at the money that those teams are going to be making because of it and say, you know, we want that too, you know. Whether it's a 50-50 split or they get, I don't know. I don't know how it works. But to their credit, to the Brown family credit, they have not pushed this. They haven't been, I don't know, militant about we need this and we need that. It's not like it was back in 1995
No, over
or
the
whatever.
Years, this is true. Over the years, it has, they could have, under the lease, they could have said,
oh, yeah.
You owe us, the lease says, like the many times, says, many times over the past 20 years, they could have done that. And it has now just played out to the end.
Yeah, they've been very fair about the whole thing and very much a partner. I give them a big credit for that, but that's different than asking for them to pay for half a rehab of this place or half a new place.
So we do have to wrap up pretty soon here, but do you think the Bengals are? That does beg the question, are the Bengals going to win this year?
I don't know. You look into your crystal ball and tell me if Joe Burrow is going to be healthy, and I can tell you anything you want to know about the Cincinnati Bengals. You know,
that's the big question.
That's the question
healthier this year. You know, he's not coming off of a appendix surgery, looking, you know, 20 pounds lighter and pale. He's, you know, he seems to have this whatever it was back.
As long as he can stay healthy, I mean, is he going to be a Hall of Fame type quarterback, or is he going to be one of those guys when you look back and say, if only he hadn't been Humpty Dumpty?
It's the pivot year, right? This is the year we're going to know one way or the other.
I think as long as Burrow is here, and I don't think they'll ever let him go, this team will have a chance. How good of a chance? I don't know. I think this year is important. Yeah, it's probably the last year with T. Higgins. I don't think they'll tag him again. And they have a good team, not a great team. I don't think anybody has a great team. And the division is very good and has gotten better.
The division is good.
So
do you think that our players gel well together, which I think is important? You can see that they're friends and they get along.
I'm not down there anymore to see that. I don't know. It seems like, you know, Zach's culture club is, you know, he's developed it to an extent that it has helped them in the past. But things change. The NFL changes, personalities, you know, human natures change. And when they start winning and they start playing well and they want more money and they sit out and they do this and they do that, that camaraderie doesn't always hold up. I mean, in some places it has. I mean, Pittsburgh, great example. They have a, you know, Mike Tomlin, the standard is the standard. They're always in the mix. They have a culture there. I think Taylor is starting to develop that culture, and he's done a good job with it so far, but it's going to be tested. It's being tested. right now.
So we've talked a lot about the Bengals. One of the things I wanted to ask you is back to the Reds for a moment. Cincinnati, the birthplace of professional baseball, legendary players. Is this still a baseball town today?
I think it's sort of a bandwagon baseball town. I do. And I love bandwagon fans. I've said that a million times. I'm a bandwagon fan. Bandwagon fans get things accomplished. Good for them. We need more of them. But I don't think, you know, the kids now and even their parents didn't grow up watching Wire to Wire. You know, they don't, you know, Pete Rose. Why do you guys keep writing about Pete Rose? You know, so the big red machine feelings dissipate every year as we all get older. Memories of 1990 are the same way, and they're being replaced by soccer fans and NFL fans and college football fans. So I think the only place that can legitimately say now is a baseball town, St. Louis. I don't think this is a football or this is a baseball town anymore. When you look at every level, you know, before high school, you know,
right.
The little Cardinals at Colerain, right? High school football, college football, and obviously the Bengals. I think because football is football and baseball is not, that's a big reason. But I think this is more a football town than a baseball town right now.
And then I just wanted to go back to, before we got diverted, and we'll wrap up, you are also a book author. I looked this up. I can't believe it's almost 10 years ago now.
Yeah, we were talking about that and we got away.
Right, yeah. I won't call you, I don't think advocate is the wrong word, but you've become an evangelist for the quality of life someone born with Down syndrome can lead. Through your book, certainly, An Uncomplicated Life, which came out in 2015. I can't believe it's been that long, about your daughter. Talk a little bit about that book, what it meant for your family, your daughter, and is it still something that, you know, there's people that identify with you as the sports columnist of the Enquirer and forever will. But my guess is there's a whole other community of people that see you as someone who gave voice to that.
Yeah, people told me I should write a book, and in a couple of years I resisted it. I don't think my daughter is special other than the fact that she's my daughter. Why would anybody want to read this? But I finally decided, well, maybe there is something there. And for a couple of years, it was just pure catharsis, Burl. It was blood on a page, right? And Bob Dylan, blood on the tracks, writing about breakups with, you know, girlfriends and stuff. This was about our lives with our daughter. It was very easy to do. It came right out of me. And I like to think that it's helped some people.
But it did, and you used your platform for that. You easily could have been like, I have a lot of sports columns to write every second, and I'm not going to put my actual life out there, but you did do that.
And well, I did that a lot, and I still do it on the blog where I use my family for fodder.
The kid down the hall.
The kid down the hall, the trips to the mountains. And Jillian was part of that. Jillian getting married, Jillian going to NKU, Jillian being manager of the basketball team there, on and on and on. I thought people would find that interesting. I hoped that
they
some
did.
Would find it helpful.
They did.
You know? But I didn't write the book because of that. I wrote it because it was cathartic and because I did believe that it might help somebody out there, you know, who just had a child.
Well, when you did it, there wasn't the kind of platforms. People can find communities now on social media and TikTok, and you feel less alone as much as doom scrolling, but you can be in your communities with people. But when you started doing it, there wasn't that connection. You might have been like, I'm the only person going through this.
Other than most cities have Down syndrome associations. The one here, DSAGC, is very highly regarded. There are national organizations National Down Syndrome Congress. And so there are organizations, but you're right, Sherry, it wasn't, you couldn't, you know, go on TikTok for hints for how to breastfeed a child born, you know, Down syndrome. Yeah, and we spoke all over the country. I mean, we spent a solid 6 months.
On the road, yeah, the book tour. That had to be looking back on that now, did you understand at the time, like, what a special opportunity that was? Mm-hmm. Not every father-daughter duo gets to go on a book tour together.
Yeah, not every father-daughter duo gets to go to the local Down syndrome chapter in Minneapolis and be given passes to the Mall of America amusement park, right? They have an amusement park inside this mall in Minneapolis. Jillian still talks about that. And every once in a while, she'll still say, are we ever going to do a book tour again? I said, no, those days are long gone, Jillian. But we will occasionally still get asked to speak in front of some local group. Like, we do an annual thing with a class at Georgetown University. First year we went, and the last 5-6 times it's been FaceTime. So there's still people who are interested in the subject, talking about it and seeking my opinion. I always said the person who should have written the book's my wife. She ran the show. I added some muscle on occasion when needed, but basically just kind of served as the backup. You know, I was the backup catcher on our team, but she deserved more of the credit than I did.
Well, if you go to Google and look up Paul Daugherty Substack, you'll find The Morning Line. If you go to Amazon and type in Paul Daugherty, you will see An Uncomplicated Life. So that's the plug for the book.
Thank you.
We have to wrap up, Sherry, I know.
Yeah.
So, Paul, thank you for your time. Congratulations on... And you're there with a heavy hitter list of Cincinnati sports...
Yeah.
Journalist legends, Denny Jansen, the late John Fay of the Enquirer. So congratulations.
Thank you. Thanks very much. And I don't really know anything about it. I'm excited. I was honored when they selected me. I'm especially pleased that I'm going in with DJ and John Popovich, who befriended me very early on when I got here in 88, and whose work I really admired and respected.
I'm excited for the event to see you all interact with each other, because it is a small journalism community, because it's a small city and we do know each other. It'll be fun to see, like, the relationships and everything. So it's the 16th.
There we go. Well, with that, again, congrats, Paul. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
And I know people are reading you, because I am, so...
Good.
Keep
I appreciate it,
up. It.
Thanks for having me, guys. My pleasure.
Thank you.
Well, that was fun catching up with Doc. And I have to say, he looks refreshed, relaxed, like the weight of the world's off his shoulder. I think retirement, air quote retirement, suits him well. Getting away from the daily grind of being the Enquirer sports columnist. What do you think, Sherry?
Well, no comment on that being the truth about a lot of my former colleagues, Burrell. Possibly their weight not bouncing around like mine does, but I wouldn't trade the stress for anything now. But yes, he is his own boss now, and he still loves to write, and he still does it.
Yep.
But it's just in a different way. It's interesting.
Well, that conversation, I think, was full of Cincinnati moments. But since we're talking sports, I wanted to tell you that the last Reds game I was at, which was a week or so ago, they were doing the ceremonial first pitches, you know. And there's a lot of cool people that you see that get asked to do the first pitch.
Jim Boardman
we talked about. But most of the time, kind of the crowd just sort of goes about its business, finding their seats, not really paying attention. Not that night, because throwing the first pitch was Cincinnati's latest Olympic medalist, twice medalist, Carson Foster, who won a bronze and a silver. He's a swimmer. And he threw out the first pitch, and everybody was on their feet cheering for, you know, the local kid done good. And it, and I could tell it was important for the Reds, too, because instead of just some random person being the catcher for the first pitch, it was Reds manager David Bell. And he looked just as excited as anyone else to, you know, be amidst our Olympic gold our Olympic medalists. So I thought that was one of the coolest things I've seen at a Reds game for a while.
You know what? It's a good reminder about how important swimming is here. Like, we really are renowned for our high school swimmers. And he's a graduate of Sycamore High School, also known for their swimming. And he brought a lot of attention to it. So I'm excited for that.
Well, we have a great video on Cincinnati.com where one of our high school reporters, Brendan Connolly, who's covered swimming, catches up with him. He has been busy since he's been back into town. So, you know, he graduated from Sycamore High School. He's currently at the University of Texas where he swims. But at Sycamore High School, he, you know, broke all kinds of records while he was a swimmer there. He did his club swimming for a club in Mason. So he has been doing the rounds, you know, popping into schools, talking to students about, you know, what a little hard work will do for you, just sharing his inspirational story all over town, which I think is a pretty cool thing. So we didn't talk too much about the Olympics on this podcast, but I just wanted to throw that out there as a Cincinnati moment that I was happy to witness. Thrilled to witness was, you know, watching a stadium full of people who didn't get to go to Paris to see this kid, give him that local, you know, standing ovation. It was just describing it. I got like chills on my arm. So anyway.
And the pomp and circumstance part of the games is always the Reds do it right. They really do, with the people they honor and the special things they do. And it's probably all of baseball, but they do a really good job.
It almost made up for the fact that the Reds got blown out that night and started.
Oh, bro, you didn't have to tell me that. I know.
And started and started what has now become like a, I don't know, nine game, losing nine out of the last 12 games. I mean, it's been a little rough.
I'm for going us Red tonight. Fans I'll bring here. Them some luck.
All right. Well,
and
anyway,
for your special hot dog too. That's on my list.
Oh, have you tried that yet?
No, I haven't been to the game. I'm going Sherry, to the game tonight. We talked about it last week.
Sherry, you have got to try the big red dog. I mean,
That's my dinner tonight.
All right. Well, shall we wrap this thing up?
Yep.
Okay. Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the That's So Cincinnati podcast, a production of the Enquirer and Cincinnati.com.
If you enjoyed the podcast, please give us a rating and share it with a friend who loves all things Cincinnati.
I love that dramatic pause, Sherry. Finally, if you value local journalism, and I know you do, and haven't subscribed for full digital access to Cincinnati.com, now is a great time. Just go to Cincinnati.com and click on the subscribe button to see a special offer for new subscribers.
Thanks again. See you guys next week.